Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Wednesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Ian Tuttle of National Review is in for Jim Garrity today. Good, bad, crazy martinis for conservatives. And Ian, usually you get the rough job of coming in on a Wednesday during the Republican primary season and explaining how Donald Trump's really good night could have been even better and even worse for conservatives. So today, you get your job is slightly easier. Last night in Wisconsin, Ted Cruz easily wins the Wisconsin primary. He wins it by about 13 points, which is bigger than any poll we saw out there, and certainly bigger than the tightening polls we saw in the final couple of days. At his victory rally in Milwaukee on Tuesday night, Cruz made a couple of important points. He says, first of all, a few weeks ago, this was supposed to be a dead cinch for Donald Trump.
A state that just 3 weeks ago the media had written off. Of 3 weeks ago, the media said Wisconsin was a perfect state for Donald Trump. But the hardworking men and women of Wisconsin stood and campaigned tirelessly to make sure that tonight was a victory for every American.
But beyond that, Ian, the math is very important, as Cruz pointed out.
In the coming days, when Colorado and Wyoming finish voting, we are likely to have gained over 100 delegates on Donald Trump. Yeah. And as a result of tonight, as a result of the people of Wisconsin defying the media, defying the pundits, I am more and more convinced that our campaign is going to earn the 1,237 delegates needed to win the Republican nomination.
And as he later pointed out, that could happen at the convention, because it's very, very unlikely that he'll actually win the 1,237 in the primaries. But it's also getting increasingly unlikely that Trump will get to 1,237 in the primaries. And for anyone interested in a truly conservative Republican nominee, Ian, a good night, doubled up by the fact that Bernie Sanders trounces Hillary Clinton and the conservatives win a key race for Wisconsin Supreme Court. So in the end, conservatives have reason to be smiling today.
I'm so excited to be with you, Greg, on the morning when I can smile, you know, when I can say that there's hope and light in the world. It's just, it's really great. Yeah, last night was huge for a couple reasons. The ones you pointed out, of course, but also digging down into the details. Cruz first transitioned his Iowa ground game into Wisconsin in just a massively effective way. That's going to be very important going on to further states, but it shows what's so revealing about Cruz and the reason that he's still in this race, which is his ground game. And that was the case in Iowa. It was the case in the states he won on Super Tuesday. And now he's managed to adapt. And those southern states that he thought were going to be his firewall, those SEC states, didn't go the way that they wanted. And then the Cruz campaign was able to pivot and turn the firewall into western states like Wisconsin, Montana, which is coming up, Wyoming, like he mentioned there. That's huge. The second thing is that campaign effort dovetailed anti-Trump forces in Wisconsin to just terrific effect. So you had not only major conservative officials come out for Cruz like Scott Walker, but you had the radio hosts, Charlie Sykes and Vicky McKenna and others who didn't go the way of so many of the national talk show pundits, but have actually stuck by true conservative principles. And those people made a difference, an enormous difference for voters in Wisconsin. They are part of the reason that Cruz not just won, but vastly outperformed his polls and ultimately beat Trump by double digits. That's all very, very important. I make another point, which is, I think, important going forward. Trump had a bad week in the wake of Utah, right? There was the Heidi Cruz debacle, there were the Lewandowski charge, and then the abortion comments. All of that happened in the span of a week. And during that, there were people asking, where is Ted Cruz? You know, why isn't Ted Cruz on CNN with Wolf Blitzer, et cetera, et cetera? The same question was actually being asked in the lead up to Super Tuesday. Where is Ted Cruz? You know, why aren't we seeing him on the national shows, et cetera? That's not how Cruz is winning states. It's important because it's showing the national media in this primary, contrary to what we're thinking, actually in a certain way is not the make or break factor. Cruz won Texas, which he should have won, but by a massive margin. He won Wisconsin and he won Oklahoma using something of the same strategy, and Iowa, which was being on the ground, talking to people, getting in with the local opinion makers, the local officials, when it seems like when people get to shake hands with Cruz, when they see him at, you know, rallies and town halls, et cetera, in their hometown, when they actually get to know him, they like him. They like him on the ground. So it's not the case right now that he needs this massive media blitz. He doesn't use a Trump strategy and doesn't need it. Very quickly, what happens going forward? It's lousy that New York is the next state because that's allowed the Trump folks to say, oh, you know, dismiss Wisconsin. Trump's going to crush New York and then carry that momentum through the Acela states, the eastern seaboard states that follow New York. That's partly true. You know, Trump's obviously likely to win his own home state, but Cruz could be competitive and keep him under a 50% threshold. But what's most important are the western states coming up. I mentioned Montana earlier, and then Indiana and Nebraska, which are states that look a lot like Wisconsin, states where you're likely to be able to transfer that ground game very effectively, and where Cruz is going to have a lot of help from influential state lawmakers in Indiana, Mike Pence, in Nebraska, Ben Sasse. So it's very, very possible that Cruz could use this momentum to hold the margins down in the East and then shut out Trump in these key Midwestern states. And that's all you need for a contested convention. I would say after last night, a contested convention has never looked likelier. Combining that with the fact that we're getting all of these internal reports about the Trump campaign's internal disarray, I would say that today is a very, very good day for Cruz, but also all of the folks who are anti-Trump.
Excellent analysis. I think the only correction is that people in Wisconsin and Indiana would refer to themselves as Midwesterners, not Western states. But I know what you mean.
Yeah.
West of the Acela corridor is what you meant there. And you mentioned, of course, heading to a potentially a contested convention, depending on how the delegates shake out in the remaining states. And if, in fact, we get to that point and we can't get a nominee on the first ballot and or subsequent ballots, little by little, more and more states, the delegates will be free to leave the person that they're currently bound to and vote for whoever they want. That is called following the rules in most states. In the Trump campaign, it's called stealing the nomination if you follow those rules. And Roger Stone, who's officially not part of the Trump campaign, has decided that they're not going to stand for this tactic from the Cruz campaign of trying to get their people as delegates who would still vote for Trump on as many ballots as they have to and then go to Cruz if they're still not a nominee. Roger Stone was speaking with Stephen Molyneux on Freedom Main Radio and talked about what they have in store for Cleveland if, in fact, Trump gets there without 1237.
Which is why I have urged Trump supporters, come to Cleveland. March on Cleveland. Join us in the Forest City. We're going to have protests, demonstrations. We will disclose the hotels and the room numbers of those delegates who are directly involved in the steal. If you're from Pennsylvania, we'll tell you who the culprits are. We urge you to visit their hotel and find them.
Ian, apparently, if you are a delegate, other delegates know what room number you're in, so that information won't be that hard to get. But to basically invite people to storm people's hotel rooms is a prescription for disaster.
Yeah. Well, and of course, it's perfectly in line with the candidate he's supporting who, you know, says that there bad things would happen if Trump doesn't get the nod at a contested convention. Look, there are a couple things. First of all, it's Roger Stone. So let's just, you know, put this out there. The renowned Nixon era dirty trickster of the Republican Party. So you can interpret that one of two ways. One is that Stone likes being in the thick of it and likes being the center of attention, much like the candidate he supports again. And so there's probably some talk and some bluster here. The second is this is the man who helped organize the so-called Brooks Brothers riot during the Florida recount and has many other unsavory acts in his political past. So this is actually, you know, entirely possible. You know, it's no doubt that Stone might actually do this. In either case, it's instructive that he's coming out and saying this. because this is more of the Trump folks disliking the rules because the rules aren't helping them. They're complaining and whining and peddling conspiracy theories because they didn't understand how this process worked from the beginning. There was an RNC meeting between Reince and Trump and some of Trump's advisors the other day. And according to people who were in the meeting, when Reince was explaining how the delegate selection procedure works, Trump turned to his staff and said, "We haven't been on top of this. We haven't been doing what we needed to do." It's because they didn't know what they needed to do, because they thought that this was just sort of some sort of magical process where the people come out and sweep you to power. It doesn't work like that. There are a variety of, there's a massive process, it's a complex process, but all the rules are out there. We're not hiding them away. Those rules are in place to provide checks on a sort of direct majoritarian democracy, which is how Trump and his supporters think this works, but it doesn't. So that's why Cruz is working behind the scenes to make sure that if Trump doesn't have the requisite 1237, once those delegates are unbound, they'll pivot elsewhere. That's not stealing an election. That's how the rules work. That's how the delegate procedures work. And it's disingenuous for the Trump folks to say the delegates will somehow be misrepresenting the voters' will, when in fact the delegates are generally selected by a long and complicated process. I mean, let me give you an example. In Texas, the way that Texas delegates are decided, and of course most of them are bound for Cruz as is because he won the state, but there is a precinct convention on the night of the primary or shortly after. Then there is a county convention or a senatorial district convention. Then there is a state convention, and then there's a national convention. And delegates are elected from each convention to the next, where they go through another series of elections to get to the next convention and another series. So by the time a national delegate actually gets to Cleveland from Texas, they'll have gone through a four-layer process of being vetted and pitching themselves and being elected by other delegates who are at these conventions. So there's a whole process of sort of checks and balances to make sure that the people who are actually going to go to Cleveland, the people who are making these decisions, are responsible people who are in fact representing the will that's at work. The Trump people don't like this. That's why we talk about the Trumps as sort of rank, gross populists. They don't want these checks that are built into the system to temper rogue majoritarian democracy. They want the will of the people regardless of the rules. That's not how this works. I wrote this a couple weeks ago when we were getting these conspiracy theories, but if the Trump folks are sort of anti-check and balance in the nominating procedures, that's alarming, because there's no indication that they would suddenly be eager to abide by the Constitution's checks and balances if they were then elevated into power. We should be able to look at the one situation and extrapolate to the latter. And I think that if you do that, the result is alarming.
Just two quick follow-ups on this from the Politico story regarding Stone's comments to Stefan Molyneux. He basically is making a two-point argument as to why Cruz is stealing this election. Number one, they're trying to steal it in two different ways. It is interesting to me that in every primary or caucus where Ted Cruz won, we have certified, proven, sworn evidence of massive voter fraud, which will later be presented to the Credentials Committee in Cleveland in an attempt to unseat delegates who are illegally elected, which makes you wonder if it's such an effective, massive voter fraud operation, why he's not using it in more states. the other method of theft, Stone elaborated, quote, is the phenomena of the Trojan horse delegates. Listen carefully. Where Trump has won a primary. Let's take Texas, for example. He didn't win Texas. Or he won a share of the votes in a primary. Trump got 40% of the votes in Texas. That's not true. He got 26% of the vote. He got about 40% of the vote if you only count the candidates who met the threshold. So the sleight of hand that Stone is trying to use here, in addition to just flat-out blatant lies, is just amazing, that they're trying to construct this whole – they're trying to steal this nomination thing based on complete fiction.
Exactly. This is Roger Stone's fiction that Michelle Fields had a little bomb in her hand as Trump's. You know, it's just liars all the way down.
Oh, amazing. All right. Quickly to the crazy martini now. And Ian, political correctness drives us crazy, and we hate to see it anywhere. But there's sometimes just kind of a slice of deliciousness when it actually happens to eat one of their own. Madeleine Albright. The last time we heard from Madeleine Albright, she was stumping very ineffectively for Hillary Clinton up in New Hampshire and was most famous for this little nugget.
You have to help. Hillary Clinton will always be there for you. And just remember, there's a special place in hell for women who don't help each other.
So there you go. Well, here's the Fox News story. Madeleine Albright is now the source of controversy among liberals. She is a liberal icon and was America's first female Secretary of State. But not everyone at a California college is thrilled that, quote, white feminist and repeated genocide enabler Madeleine Albright has been lined up to give next month's commencement address. Soon after, officials at all-female Scripps College in Claremont, California, announced Albright would speak to graduates. An article in the school paper derided the Czech-born diplomat for her skin color and previous policy positions, and other students posted their concerns on social media. Quote, just out of curiosity, does anyone know how many, and then in brackets, people of color we've had as guest commencement speakers at Scripps, asked one student. Another one says, with Madeleine Albright being our commencement speaker, and a war criminal, and a white feminist, I know some of our professors are refusing to be on stage. I'm wondering if any of the students were planning a protest or perhaps some sort of show of disagreement with Albright and what she stands for. So, Ian, the college kids are clearly going further and further insane, but it's fun to watch the left try and navigate this because now it's not good enough to be a liberal. It's not even good enough to be a feminist liberal. If you're a white feminist liberal, we want nothing to do with you.
It's fantastic, you know, these people saying we shouldn't take Madeleine Albright's advice to support Hillary Clinton just because she's a woman, but then turning around and saying it's a problem that Madeleine Albright is white, right? I mean, they think in these absurd categorical terms. It is utterly delicious when this happens to the left, and the idea that Madeleine Albright, and of course, you know, I and all my colleagues here at National Review and many others on the right have, you know, ample disagreements on policy and principles with Madeleine Albright. And we don't think that there's a special place in hell. We think there's probably a special gated community in heaven for women who vote against Hillary Clinton. But look, she was the Secretary of State, a very accomplished woman. This is just absolute absurdity. Combined with the fact that, if I'm not mistaken, Angela Davis was at Scripps not too long ago, the head of the Communist Party USA who murdered a policeman and then fled to Cuba, where she's been living courtesy of the Castro regime. And then she was hailed by the Scripps paper as a heroic, courageous black agitator or something, you know, something like that. So there's a real dishonesty, there's a real sort of villainy at work in all of this. And it's only the beginning of April, so, you know, the most wonderful time of the year in which commencement speakers get their invitations rescinded is just beginning.
Ah, fantastic. Do you get the sense that between Hillary losing to Obama and now what we're seeing in stories like this, that somehow with the rapid and rabid advance of the politically correct culture, that somehow the feminists got leapfrogged? And now that's just not good enough, and you got to check several more boxes to be acceptable?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. The buzz over intersectionality, right? It's not enough to think in one. It's not enough to think in terms of one category of oppression. You now have to, you know, make sure that you're cross-tabbing all of your various oppressions. If Obama really wanted to fill that Supreme Court seat, he'd have found a black, lesbian, transgender, double amputee who, you know, thinks she's a mongoose on Thursdays, you know, and then no one in the Republican Party would have been able to respond.
That was the biggest criticism from the left. Not that Garland wasn't liberal enough, but that it was a white male. Amazing. Just absolutely amazing. But at least the fire is aimed in the other direction for a moment. Ian, always good to have you with us. We'll talk to you later.
All right. Thanks, Greg.
Ian Tuttle of National Review in for Jim Garrity today. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Jim will be back on Thursday. Please join us then for the next 3 Martini Lunch.